Okay, gather around, kids, because I'm going to tell you a scary story from where I grew up in Farmington, Connecticut, where the mill rate is 24.07.
Wow, that is scary. Hope I never go there.
That's not even the scary part. There was a family right on our street, which was one-armed lamplighter with a hideous scar lane. They had two children, and one night they hired a babysitter and went out to dinner.
A babysitter like you?
Well, sort of.
Because our last babysitter was here during a lunar eclipse, and she ate some drugged pizza and woke up in a hospital covered in bandages and pregnant by the devil.
What? Holy crap. Well, anyway, this is my scary story. So the mom and dad go out to dinner, and when they're having dessert, the babysitter calls the mom's cell phone and says, "I'm sorry to disturb you, but the children can't fall asleep because they're bothered by that life-sized clown statue in their bedroom." And the mom says, "Take the children right now and run for the car." And the babysitter asks why. And the mom says, "We don't have a clown statue."
Is that it?
Yeah.
What's the scary part?
The clown in the children's room who escaped from the Farmington homicidal psychotic clown hospital.
He's probably not so bad.
Yeah, sometimes we have clowns who come and stand in our bedroom.
You have what? That's horrible. What kind of parents let that happen?
I think you need to take a long, hard look at your own prejudices. I mean, you're so quick to assume a clown who shows up in a room is dangerous.
He might just be lonely.
Here, have some pizza and we'll talk about it.
Oh, yes. Got extra onions. Thank you. Wow, that's a really good crust. Anyway, I also want you to listen to this radio show about the hidden legends of Connecticut. Wow, I am suddenly just really exhausted. Who's that red guy? What does it say on his chest? Stan? Ugh.
You missed a letter. And now, to tell the story of the grumpy old man who got electrocuted by his radio equipment, Colin McEnroe.
I don't know that story. But we are spending Halloween talking a little bit about the hidden legends of Connecticut. Sorry about what happened to Guyon there. But I'm sure we'll find another announcer. Or maybe she can bring the baby in here. You know, we can make the baby part of our lives. As we go along here, we're happy to hear your stories, too. You may tweet us. Tweet Master Greg Hill in the house at WNPR Colin on the Twitter. That's WNPR Colin. You may also phone us, 860-275-7266. I will say that more slowly. If you have a story, a Connecticut legend, a legend that maybe you know that other people don't know, because in fact, we do have legend hunters here in the room. I'm going to introduce them in a second, but I want you to feel free to call up to 860-275-7266. Let me tell you who is here. Zach Lamott is the author of Connecticut Lore, Strange, Off-Kilter, and Full of Surprises. David Leff is the author of many books, including Hidden in Plain Sight, A Deep Traveler Explores Connecticut. Walter Woodward is an associate professor of history at the University of Connecticut and Connecticut State historian. In a little while, also, we'll talk to John Nowinski. He's a paranormal investigator with Smoking Gun Research Agency. You may need him sooner than you think. All right, as I say, we're happy to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Walter, usually when you're in here, we're talking about a more sort of documentable area of history. You know, we're talking about what happened at this battle or Charter Oak problem. Or we're talking about things that sort of show up on the rolls of history. Now we're talking about something a little bit different, but I assume it's something that a historian can't completely ignore, how people talk about their beliefs about where they live.
Yeah, this is folklore, and folklore is in many ways just as important as the footnoted history, because folklore are the stories that people either make up out of their experiences or adapt from real stories and turn them into stories that are more interesting and sometimes more scary.
And David Leff, I know you sort of say in some ways you're interested in the stories. In a certain sense, there's ghosts everywhere, but I'll let you flesh out that thought.
Yeah, there are ghosts everywhere, and not just on Halloween and not just in the dark. I'm not talking about the supernatural or Hollywood ectoplasms. I'm talking about the fragments, the penumbras of our past that exist all around us for us to discover if we know how to look, if we know how to read the landscape in old mill dams or cellar holes or highways that are truncated in the middle of nowhere. And when we combine that with the stories that we might talk to old-timers about or find in the library or on the web, when we combine the physical remnants of the past with the stories and a little bit of imagination, we can see the ghosts of the past. In my hometown, I can visualize John Brown walking down Main Street in Collinsville to the company where he bought the pikes for his raid on Harper's Ferry. When I go to Willimantic and I look at those old mills from American Thread, after being at the Textile History Museum, I can envision the mill girls working at that backbreaking labor in that factory. Those are the kinds of things that we can see if we use a little bit of imagination, see what the remnants of the past are around us, and know some of the stories.
Well, there is a difference between visualizing something and actually thinking you saw it, and that's a distinction you're making right now. But, Zach Lamott, reading your book, I feel as though you are prepared to at least entertain the possibility that it doesn't always take imagination, that there may, in fact, be things here that are not strictly of the kind of rational earth that we think about.
Very true. Even though I might not have seen anything myself, I've gotten stories from people that, even people close to me, about experiences that they've had themselves, reputable sources, and combine those with tales that have been ingrained in the state from its Native American days to colonial days into the present, and there may be just something out there.
As we go along here, our guests will be sort of, if you have questions about specific legends, there's a lot of them that are kind of front and center, whether it's Dudley Town or Gungie Wump or the vampires of Jewett City or the Black Dog. I never quite get the Black Dog thing straight, but I'm sure you guys can straighten me out on that. But if you have questions, or if you have, as Zach says, a story of your own, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. I'm going to ask each one of you just to sort of run through a favorite of yours. And David, maybe you can kick us off, because I know you just mentioned Canton visualizing John Brown in Canton. But there are people who imagine that they see a headless horseman, not in Sleepy Hollow, but in Canton. Tell us about that.
Yeah, of course, Ichabod Crane and Sleepy Hollow are the most famous manifestations of a supernatural story in our literature. But there is the headless horseman of Canton, and I love these supernatural stories because they really enrich the world around us when we understand that it's not only the rational things that we see in the daylight, but the imaginings that people have over the years that may or may not be real. And the Headless Horseman of Canton was a French paymaster during the Revolutionary War. He was traveling the Hartford-Albany Turnpike over Avon Mountain. It was an arduous trip back in those days. And he stopped at a tavern in Canton. He was loaded with a lot of gold to pay the troops in Saratoga. And he sat around the fire there. He had a meal. He retired to his room. He was never seen again. And then the authorities came. They investigated. They could find no vestige of him. But in the years since, people have said that they have seen this image of this headless man with these big saddlebags that would have been the paymasters riding out of the mist in an area where at one time there were woods, then a dairy farm, then the Canton Golf Course, and now the shops at Farmington Valley. A headless man riding out of the mist. And the thing is that that tavern, which was just in the center of Canton on Route 44, burned in the 1870s. And when they dug away all the ashes, they found a skeleton in the basement. And the skeleton had no head.
I don't think the Headless Horseman of Canton can afford most of the things in the shops at Farmington Valley, but that's his
problem. I saw him outside of Talbot's, though.
That's right, yeah.
He has for something for his big wife. Saddlebags, yeah. For that, yeah. Kind of thing.
Pick up something for the wife. So, Zach, your book is just crawling with these stories, and some of them are contemporary, some of them are old. Are you from Eastern Connecticut?
I am. Originally, I'm from Norwich.
So you're hitting off the easy tees then. I mean, Eastern Connecticut's got, I think, pound for pound, square foot for square foot. I don't know what it is about Eastern Connecticut, the proximity to Rhode Island, who knows? But whether it's UFOs or, of course, we all know there's a space-time vortex in Sterling, Connecticut, but it's like everything's out there. So do you have a particular favorite here?
Well, coming from my hometown of Norwich, I was born and grew up in the section of Norwich Town, which, of course, has the most tangible history in the city of Norwich. So around the town of Norwich Town, you've got the town green, you've got the old cemetery, dating from the 1700s and 1800s. Now, the most intriguing story that I've come across from that area actually happened in my own home. And I didn't really know about it until I was doing research for this book. So that was sort of a cool different thing that happened. So the story goes that before I was alive, so we'll make it in the mid-70s, and there was someone staying in the house, and they were falling asleep one night. And just before they fell asleep for good, they caught this glimpse of this woman standing over them. Now, the woman, Ms. Silva is her name, that saw these apparitions, she said that the woman was looking at her and just had a mournful look about her. Now, as the scene unfolded, she actually noticed that there was not just this one woman in the room. There was a man as well. And as she's looking further, it's a whole wake scene that is really showing up before her eyes. Now, her detail of the woman's dress, what she was wearing, was pinpointed to the utmost. Also, the man she described having pointed triangular eyebrows, again, features and description that was just phenomenal, especially because she told me this story more than 30 years after it occurred. So that was something that I knew there'd been talks of things happening in my house. My house was from 1752, but I never actually heard that story in detail. And when I interviewed Ms. Silva for the book, just the description was so vivid that she was describing this wake scene as if it happened to her earlier that day.
And I mean, but what you need now is to find the portrait of the guy with the pointed eyebrows. Right?
Absolutely.
That's what locks this thing up. All right, so 860-275-7266 is our number if you want to call in. You know, Walter Woodward, I'm going to ask you for your favorite story. But before that, I think it's sort of worth noting. I was thinking about this going into the show. I mentioned it in an introduction that New England's kind of odd. Really, all of the New World is kind of a paradox in the sense that it was settled, at least the European settlements, were in many cases these Calvinists who were coming over with this idea of a kind of lean, mean theology, you know, that was not encrusted with superstition, that was not, you know, that was sort of devoid of all the sort of gewgaws and strange appurtenances that they saw Roman Catholicism having. But really, and David Hackett Fisher's incredible book, Albion's Seed, really kind of lays this out, they were very superstitious people, really,
sure,
with a lot of very magical thinking.
They were creatures of their culture, and their culture was one in which religion, science, and magic were completely interwoven and inseparable. So the same Puritans who brought over Calvinism brought all these Protestant witch fears with them. And, of course, Connecticut had its own witch hunts. We executed 11 people for witchcraft in this colony, 4 of them in Hartford. And one of the really interesting things about Hartford is that no one seems to know for sure exactly where those witches were either executed or buried. So I've been asking for a long time. Somebody says at the corner of Albany and Ivy is the best place. Another person says Gallows Hill up at Trinity College. But this is a great mystery, and you know, I suspect on Halloween, people out in the streets of Hartford just might find somebody out there looking for those places.
Do you have a particular story that you like that says Connecticut to you somehow?
Well, one of the stories I love comes from Simsbury. It's now a restaurant. It used to be a tavern, Pettibone's Tavern. It's now Abigail's Restaurant. The story was that this 18th century tavern was owned by Captain Pettibone, who was a whaler, and of course he was away at sea, and poor lonely Mrs. Pettibone was there keeping the tavern going, and he came home early from a whaling voyage and found her trysting with another man in the Pettibone house, and he became a blubbering maniac and axed them to death in the tavern. So people who go to the restaurant now will say, when you go up to the second floor by the ladies' room, which is apparently the room in which he found them, it gets cold and they see people. And sometimes people have actually reported that they see a spirit figure walking around the tables, asking people if they like the veal or something.
We should say that one thing I just sort of discovered, even just, and I think Betsy Kaplan discovered this as she was getting ready to produce these shows, our guests tend to know a lot of these overlapping stories. Like, you guys know this Pettibone Abigail story, right?
Oh, yeah, it's a very well-known story. And people feel those emanations, and who's to say what the origin of that is?
Okay, so I've got Rita calling in at 860-275-7266 from what I regard as the most supernaturally impregnated town in Connecticut. Before I say what it is, which town do you think I'm about to say?
Weathersfield.
No. Come on.
Cornwall.
No.
It's got to be in eastern Connecticut somewhere.
Yeah. All right. It's East Haddam. East Haddam. Come on. You got the Devil's Hop Yard. You got the Moodus Noises. Right. You've got Johnsonville. You've got Neolithic outer space clown heads out in the forest. I wasn't supposed to mention that one. And so here's Rita in East Haddam. Hi, Rita.
Hi. Don't forget Witch Meadow Campground. It's on the other side of me.
How could I? Witch Meadow.
Witch Meadow. In Salem, yes.
All right. Go ahead. What have you got?
Well, our house is haunted. Our home was built as a cottage in the 1950s, and there's only been one other owner other than my husband's family. So we don't know of any especially, awful things that have happened there. But it started out where my boys had a room in the basement, and I was upstairs once, and I can hear them running up and down the stairs, up and down the stairs. And I opened the door. I say, "You guys stop running up down the stairs. It's getting late." And they go, "What are you talking about? We haven't moved." And that was like the beginning of it. And then I noticed that I could hear, I've heard voices in the house when I'm home alone, almost like as if there's conversations going on, but I can't make out the words.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, just this year, my husband finally said that he actually saw somebody. He saw the basement door open and close, and then saw a dark figure walk down our hallway, and he thought it was, again, one of the kids. And he went down the hallway to follow them to help, find out what was going on, and he found them both sound asleep in their bed. So it's been happening for a few years now.
Well, I mean, you sound awfully calm about it.
Well, we were just talking about it today. It's funny you mentioned this whole thing because when the boys mention people, they're like, "Oh my God, I would move. Aren't you scared?" But there's been no malice. There's been no frightening evidence of anything like that. You know what I mean? It just seems like something or somebody is still living there with us. But there's been no, even we have cats and dogs, and no one seems afraid.
Well, one thing I will tell you is that in a little while we are going to put, assuming that you ever did want to know a little bit more about it, or, I mean, maybe why mess up a good thing, but we will have a paranormal investigator, a Connecticut-based paranormal investigator on, so you can at least jot down his name and number in case things take a turn for the worse. But, Zach, I mean, reading your book, I sort of got that feeling, too, that not every ghost story is a malicious story, is a story about an evil ghost.
Absolutely. I mean, there's stories of ghosts that basically play pranks or pull tricks, or ones that have actually, there's one story about a ghost or something, let's just say, that was making a noise that sounded like a spoon sort of being hit into a glass back and forth. And because of that noise, the owners went to the back of the house and noticed their dog had gotten loose. And because of this, I mean, maybe this was a helpful ghost.
Yeah, usually the spoon in the glass means they want the bride and groom to kiss. But the ghosts have their own traditions. This one means the dog is loose. All right, our number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. So there's some things and names that you almost have to mention if you're having a show like this talking about Connecticut supernatural lore and legend. One of them is Nick Bellantoni, who I think most people here have had some dealing with. He's our state archaeologist. David Leff, I know you actually visited Dudleytown with I always feel bad about Dudleytown. I sort of feel like, Well, we'll discuss maybe why one might feel bad about Dudleytown, particularly if you like lived anywhere near it, if you had a house anywhere in the vicinity of it, because it is curiosity seekers do tend to turn up there. But talk a little bit about visiting Dudleytown, and because I think everybody in the room here has some kind of take on it.
Well, Dudleytown was a village in Cornwall along Coltsfoot Mountain, and during the 19th century, it had a population that were engaged in some primitive agriculture, charcoaling, and other businesses. And there were stories of madness and people being crazed. There was a church there as well as homes, a schoolhouse. And when I was a teenager, the Appalachian Trail ran right down the middle of Dudleytown and was available for all to see. It got closed off because people abused the privilege, as you said, Colin. And now it's on private property, and people should go there only with permission. It's really just cellar holes and the vestiges of a main street that's left. I think if people want to see a ghost town, and Connecticut is littered with them, you wouldn't think so because we're so developed, but there are a lot of ghost towns in Connecticut, more than most people would imagine. And the best one to go see during daylight hours is Gay City State Park. It's a state park. Everyone's welcome there. There's a cemetery. There's the ruins of a mill. There are house foundations. There's a mill pond. It's a fascinating place. It was said to be settled by Methodists. There was a church. There was a couple of sawmills and also a distillery. And it was said in the early days that hard liquor was served to men at church, and maybe to help with attendance or at least move them to one kind of spirit, if not the other. And there are tales of one of the fellows who were digging the canal fleeing in terror because, as you know, a canal can make water seem to go uphill, and he thought that was the devil's work. Eventually, the first mill, which was a textile mill, burned, and then later there was a paper mill. It burned too. That was kind of the end of it. But that's really, if you want to experience a Connecticut ghost town, that's the best place to go to.
You know, Walter Woodward, he makes a great point, too, which is that there's so many different sort of layers of civilization in Connecticut. I mean, you're talking about the charcoal burners in Dudleytown. We had the people who worked on Mount Riga in Salisbury who, worked on the forge there, where I think some of the most famous, an anchor of the U.S. Constitution was forged there. But that brought in these kinds of different waves of immigrants with their own ways, their own folk ways, their own languages. They tended to become enclaves, sometimes kind of isolated enclaves where the culture didn't get disturbed that much. And then after a while, they're gone and you have something that looks like a ghost town.
Towns are formed. Some towns are successful and some towns fail. And when they fail, all over New England this happened. On hilltop towns come and go, and they are now the vestiges of our history. And I love what David said about them actually coming alive, and you can imagine the past in these towns if you know what to look for and where to look. It's a wonderful thing.
All right, that's Walter Woodward. He's our Connecticut State historian. David Leff is with us, author of Hidden in Plain Sight, A Deep Traveler Explores Connecticut. Zach Lamott's with us. He's the author of Connecticut Lore, Strange, Off-Kilter, and Full of Surprises. Before we take a break here, I just want to mention a couple of things. I don't know how this fits in exactly, but tonight at the Mark Twain House, which has its own issues with ghosts and stuff. In fact, you'll be hearing about that, I think, a bit from our next guest. But I'll be at the Mark Twain House with Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller. Penn Jillette would reject all supernatural arguments, even though he's made most of his living as a musician, but anyway, Penn Jillette and I will be there in conversation. I think it starts at 7, and I know that there are tickets available, so because it's Halloween night and stuff like that. So there's 30-40 tickets available. If you love Penn and Teller, you love Penn Jillette. I think we'll be talking a lot about his atheism and his libertarianism and stuff like that, but we'll also make sure we talk about magic. Also want to quickly mention, tomorrow we will be downtown. We'll be in downtown Hartford. It will sort of be embedded into the body of the XL Center. There's a kind of space that we can take over there. There'll be room for an audience. We'd love to have a live audience. It'll be The Nose. Jim Chapdelaine and James Hanley and Carolyn Payne will join us for The Nose. We'd love to have you come down. If you're downtown anyway, we'd love to have you come visit us there in our downtown location on Trumbull Street. We're on the Trumbull Street side of the XL Center. All right, that's all. It's time for a break. One Betsy Kaplan, two Betsy Kaplan, three Betsy Kaplan.
Tonight your ghost will ask my ghost, where is the love? the love. Tonight your ghost will ask my ghost, who put these bodies between us?
You hear that, trick-or-treaters? Just stay inside. You've got enough candy anyway. Don't make your parents walk you around in the rain. Actually, in my old neighborhood, there was a guy who gave out Jell-O shots to the parents, which we were intensely grateful for as we walked around with our children. But anyway, I don't advocate that either. Too many bad things could happen. All right, so yeah, you just heard us say who I've got in studio here with me. We welcome tweeting. Our tweetmaster Greg Hill is in the house. You can tweet at him at WNPRColin. He'll tweet back at you at WNPRColin. And he's tweeting away right now. And also, we welcome your phone calls, 860-275-7266. Briefly, we want to add to this conversation John Nowinski. John Nowinski, as I said at the beginning, is a paranormal investigator with Smoking Gun Research Agency. First of all, John Nowinski, what does that mean? What do you do?
Well, actually, it's really great. You have some great guests on today. And I think the biggest thing that Dave said that's really wonderful is that Connecticut really has a great history of just strangeness. What we do as paranormal investigators is look into that strangeness. And a lot of times there are things that are based on history, where the legends themselves fall apart. Dudleytown was a perfect example. The sort of curse of Dudleytown that people know really doesn't add up when you look at the history. But what's interesting is that the stories really lead to a lot of interesting knowledge, and some of them are strange. Some of the stories remain unexplained. So that's pretty much what we do. We look into a lot of historical aspects in Connecticut.
Actually, I'm going to be at the Mark Twain House tonight. Anything you want to tell me about that, John?
Yeah, actually, the Mark Twain House is a place we've worked with for several years. In our opinion, there's definitely energy there. And I think, you know, the paranormal gets a little bit of a bad rap from TV shows because there's a lot of claiming that everything is a ghost and things like that. Our group takes a little bit more of sort of a technical aspect to it. We feel that there is energy that basically lingers around certain locations, and a lot of them are historical sites where there has been a lot of people coming in and out. Sometimes there are things. The Mark Twain House is a great example where you can actually go not only learn about the history, but learn about what people who visited the house actually experienced, including staff that was there, including investigators that went there. There have been a myriad of different experiences in that house, everything from staff members who experienced things moving in the house to seeing apparitions to hearing things. Some of that was actually captured on videotape and audio tape, as well as photographs, and it was investigated, and no exact cause was able to be determined.
Right. There's a ghost that's choking David Left to death here right now. So that's what you hear in the background. We're working on it.
We can't wait till trick or drink time.
We've got a couple of Ghostbusters coming in here right now to help with that. We're talking to John Nowinski. So when you talk about energy, when you talk about sort of the technical side of this, so you're talking about you're making videotapes, you're making audio recordings in these places, either knocking out background noise, enhancing lower sounds, looking for things that show up on the videos. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. That's a big part of it. And, you know, the other thing is that a lot of it doesn't happen live, so to speak, not to put a pun on anything ghostly. But, you know, a lot of the incidences that we get that's a video or audio, you know, that takes a lot of time coming back and really analyzing everything, looking through it. So it's not often something that we actually see or hear happening as we're there. A lot of times it's things that show up in video where the video shows that there was nobody in the room. We know where people were at the site that night, but there's still movement or sound that comes through that isn't identifiable with any of the people that were there or any of the things that we were doing at the time.
You know, we've already had a call from Rita in East Tatum who has things going on in her house. She sounded very rational, but they really do feel as though the house is haunted. They don't feel it's haunted in a bad way. Nobody's been mean to them or anything like that. But they've seen things that they can't explain any other way. In a little while, Zach Lamott's going to tell us a story from Basra that is absolutely, truly chilling. It's a contemporary story that he's collected. So in some of these cases, John, I'm assuming at a certain point, maybe you sort of look at everything you've got and say to a homeowner or to people who are dealing with a specific site, well, there's some stuff here that, you know, really doesn't make a whole lot of rational sense and really probably fits into the area of the paranormal. And they say to you, well, John, we get this stuff out of my house. Now, is that something you do, or do you have a referral service to somebody else, or what do you do about that?
Yeah, I suppose in a way you could call it a referral service. You know, the idea of what people think of as exorcisms and things like that, house cleansings, again, it's something Hollywood has made a much bigger deal about it than it actually is in real life. But we don't actually do sort of that service. What we do is strictly an investigation service, where we do actually go into lots of times it's people's individual houses who have had one or two more experiences in the house, and they call us or contact us and say that they've had, for example, they believe that they heard or saw something in their house, and they'd like us to come in and check it out. And we do that, and sometimes we do turn around and say, well, you know what, we did actually pick up what we believe to be energy in the house, and exactly what you said. We actually turn around, we present that information to the individuals in the house, and it's up to them to basically take it or not. And, you know, a lot of times, though, it's very interesting, because a lot of times people sense something in their house, and they're really just looking for sort of the validation that they're not going crazy. And so when we present something to them, more often than not, people actually look at us and say, oh, okay, at least I know that it's not just us, or yeah, at least I know that there is something there. So actually rarely does it really come into a case where somebody turns around and says, you know, I want it gone, or, you know, it's really, you know, scaring the family, so to speak.
All right. Well, listen, first of all, now I know who to call if I have that problem. Who are you going to call? John Nowinski. Thanks for being with us. I want to swing things back to the calls a little bit. And also just to the legends that are around. We've already gotten one email or tweet or something like that asking us about Hannah Crana, the Witch of Monroe. Every time I bring up something like this, I expect them all to look blankly at me here in the studio. And instead they go, oh, yeah, that one. So I don't know. Zach, do you want to start us off with Hannah Crana?
Hannah Crana, I know as the Wicked Witch Monroe, taking place in the Stepney area. I'm not quite familiar with all the details about it. Do one of you guys want to jump in?
My recollection is people thought she was a witch, and she was murdered, I think, buried in the Stepney Cemetery, and now she comes back and commutes with people along the road in front of the cemetery, shows up in their car or along the side of the road or...
like the Green Lady of Burlington,
yeah,
too.
Who, mm-hmm. She's green because she drowned in a swamp, right?
Right,
or
yeah,
she
exactly
was drowned in a swamp. Yeah.
See, they know these stories. All right, our number 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I think we might be able to stump the band with this one, though. Here's Don from Derby. Hi, Don.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad. I just had a question. I moved to Derby about 2 years ago, and about a year and a half, somebody mentioned the Derby Opera House to me and how it's pretty haunted, but didn't really have any stories to tell me about. Do you guys know anything or have any stories to tell about it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Well, first of all, what I would say is that if you can find an unhaunted old opera house in Connecticut, you can make that a tourist attraction, the one that isn't haunted. Because, I mean, David, if there are, first of all, up and down the Connecticut River, I don't know the Derby Opera House. Up and down the Connecticut River, there were opera houses. The Goodspeed is still there. They occasionally will have a seance or two at the Goodspeed. But it seems like just sort of an obvious place to project supernatural things onto.
Well, in the 19th century, many towns had what they called opera houses, which were really just entertainment venues for plays and music and other kinds of local and sometimes regional folks to come and act or sing. And those opera houses, because they're places where music and plays take place, they're places that evoke your imagination. They ask you to imagine and to step outside the normal for a little while. So it's no surprise that those places would be associated with ghosts or legends because of what occurs inside them.
There's actually in East Haddam, there's an opera house, not the Goodspeed, but another opera house that was an opera house and a mental hospital. And that one's very bad, all right? The opera house, former mental hospital. You don't want to go there. You know, it's like the worst of two worlds. I won't even give its location out right now. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. All right. I think this one won't stump the band. Tamara from Middlebury, what have you got for us?
Midnight Mary in New Haven.
All right. Midnight Mary in Midnight Mary. All right. Who's nodding? Who's ready for Midnight Mary?
Midnight Mary.
All right, Walter.
Pink granite cemetery stone in, what is it, Evergreen Cemetery in New Haven. And it says on the stone, at high noon, just from and about to renew her daily work in her full strength of mind and body, Mary E. Hart, having fallen prostrate, remained unconscious until she died at midnight, October 15th, 1872. And in bold type on the top of the stone, it says, "The people shall be troubled at midnight and pass away." And, of course, the legend is that students will come from Yale or come from Quinnipiac, and they'll stay in the graveyard, and they'll be found in the morning dead with horrific, fearful looks on their faces, right?
That's why I never did that.
Yeah, well, it's not recommended.
No. It was similar to exams, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, we had other things to do in order to be found with scary looks on our faces. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR. Colin, I think this is a good time to take a break. When we come back, Zach will tell us in all the things that I read getting ready for the show what I consider to be the most frightening of the stories.
"Do you believe in ghosts?" he asked. "Yes, I do," she replied. "There are ghosts everywhere." "I don't believe in them," he said. "It's just a lot of superstition. In all my years, I've never seen a ghost. Not one." "Haven't you?" the woman said, and vanished.
In Chicopee, there's this dry cornfield next to an old, old house. And when you walk into the middle of the cornfield, you get no cell reception, zero bars, and you're in Chicopee. Does anybody have an Ativan? Thank you. Today's show was produced by Betsy, the crazy nurse with a big syringe, Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Garish Connolly and Tess Scarrison. Our tweetmaster is Greg Gallows Hill. Find this show, photos, and other awesome stuff at WNPR.org. Voiceover help in the intro by Katie Talarski and Tucker Ives. The part of Bill Curry was played by Freddy Krueger. On tomorrow's show, James Hanley, Carolyn Payne, and Jim Chapdelaine take your phone calls on the talk-worthy topics of the week on The Nose. And now, back to Colin.
All right, here in the studio with us, Zach Lamott. His book is Connecticut Lore, Strange, Off-Kilter, and Full of Surprises. David Leff, author of many books, has a book of poetry out right now called Tinker's Dam. But we're talking about Hidden in Plain Sight, A Deep Traveler Explores Connecticut. Walter Woodward is our Connecticut State Historian, Associate Professor of History at the University of Connecticut. I want to mention, if you want more David Leff and more Hidden in Plain Sight, he'll be talking about it November 6th, 7:45, it's a strange time, 7:45 p.m. In Suffield, Connecticut. I think at the Kent Memorial Library in Suffield, Connecticut. He'll also be talking about this particular book on November 14th at Torrington Historical Society in Torrington. Anyway, you can consult his website, get more information about where he is and what he's up to. Let's grab a sort of non-ghost story. Before we go to Zach's really scary story, let's go to a sort of non-ghost story. Here's Susan in Ellington. Hi, Susan.
So I took a job at a place that was a business in an old building. And when I started working there, they told me that they had a ghost. It was a little boy who played a flute. And so I was like, okay, well, that sounds pretty awesome, right?
Right.
So I started noticing that the flute playing, which was absolutely terrible, would only happen on really windy days. So I started thinking, maybe we've got less than a ghost and more of some type of problem in the old house. And after doing a little bit of investigating, came to realize that when they remodeled the house into a building, they had closed off a kitchen but had not closed off one of the oven ventilation escapes. So when the wind would blow, it would make a ghostly windy sound, but they got really mad at me. They didn't think it was funny that I was ruining their ghost story, and I became not a very favorite employee after that moment in time, but it did have a very rational explanation. It just took a little bit of investigating and using your brain to kind of puzzle it out. So, well,
thanks for calling in. Thanks for calling in, Susan,
you're
who
welcome.
Sucks the joy out of everything.
That's what my husband said.
Who do you think left that oven vent open? Satan. That's who. All right. Let me grab one more call here. I've got a lot of people calling in. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Also got some tweeters calling. calling in with some specific questions. Woodstock Charlie. I'm scared to ask about Woodstock Charlie. All right, here's AJ in Newington. Hi, AJ.
Hi. Until I lived in Norwich, I would have sworn on a stack of Bibles that I did not believe in ghosts. But we moved into this house that was built in 1901, and everyone who would walk in who had any sort of sensitivity would immediately comment that there was somebody there. And I'd ask them to describe it, and everyone described the exact same gentleman. I mean, down to the clothing. Everything was identical, every single person. And even my ex-husband would see it, and I thought it was benevolent. I never felt, and he thought it was scary. And what I discovered was the ghost would show up when my ex and I were fighting, or if something bad was happening to me, or if I was sick. And it was really interesting. My daughter-in-law has seen it. Some of my best friends have seen it. And then my neighbor across the street described how she and her late mother-in-law, used to see the same ghost and where he would stand, and they described him identically. Now, his clothes predates the house, so it's more about the property than the house. But the interesting thing is that since I've gotten a divorce and moved out, the ghost is much more active around my ex-husband, and
I'm
not trying to be vengeful. It's just
wait a minute. He stayed in the house with the ghost who didn't like him?
Yes, he stayed in the house with the
ghost
who didn't
like
him. But what's really cool is that when my older son would never take the house during the divorce, I offered it him to him and his wife because they were house hunting, and neither of them wanted it because they've seen the ghost.
Is your name Mrs. Muir?
I'm sorry?
No. Is your name Mrs. Muir? Why didn't you stay with the ghost? The ghost liked you. The ghost probably wants to date you. Why did
the
you?
The ghost was like protective of
you. Yes, exactly. The ghost likes you. So you left, and you left the ghost with the ex-husband that the ghost hates. That's not a good solution.
Well, it wasn't my idea.
It worked for you, right? You're perfectly happy with the way the whole thing worked out. All right.
A good divorce lawyer, but my thing is that the ghost, when I had a second child, I have 20 years between my two, with my second child, his bedroom was where we often saw the ghost, and I just asked him nicely to not reveal himself to our son, and he has yet, you know, it's 8 years now, and he has yet to reveal himself to our son.
That's very nice. All right, Zach could do a whole other book just on you, I think. But Zach, really quickly before we run out of time, I really did find the Basra story. This is a contemporary story, I think, told directly to you, kind of chilling. We don't have a whole lot of time, but if you can kind of give us a sense of it.
Sure, I'll sum it up. I mean, first of all, I feel like a common theme in a lot of ghost stories is history. And this location didn't really have any of that. So that's what I was very, very confused about. So it was a house that was built in the mid-80s. So we're not talking about a historic opera house or a haunted cemetery. So what it was a mother that was in her 20s had a child or has a child. And the child all of a sudden started throwing temper tantrums. And the temper tantrums got more frequent. And this was a kid that had always been very easy to please and not a kid that would be having these kind of tantrums. So the temper tantrums got worse, and basically there was just some odd events that was going around this child that culminated with the child actually doing a flip of sorts in the air and
speaking what sounded like a different language, battery-operated toys that were kind of turning on and off by themselves.
Yep. Absolutely. It was basically chaos was ensuing around this kid. And the mother took the child to the doctor to see, you know, to see what was going on. The doctor couldn't find anything that was physically wrong with the child. She also consulted an older Native American woman that tried different more spiritual remedies to it, which didn't seem to alleviate any of the goings on either. It was definitely some kind of malevolent force that had overtaken this child. There's also been kicks and scratches to other members of the family that were living in the house. And eventually they did call on a paranormal team to come in. Actually, before that, it was a minister that came in. The minister came in, asked a lot of questions to the mother about her background, about her practices, and then he was skeptical about this whole situation. He didn't see anything really wrong with the kid. Right before he left, the kid went into a trance-like state, and that's when he said, okay, yep, I'm going to come back with my sensitive friend. Someone that can has a better detection of spirits. So what they did is the minister and the sensitive came into the house a few days later and really were, you know, talking more to the mother. And also what the sensitive did was drew a picture. He can draw what he sees, and the picture ended up being exactly like the woman's grandmother that had been deceased a few years.
Ma.
Exactly, Ma. And
so long story short, because we're going to run out of time.
Yes.
Here.
The paranormal team comes in. They investigate. They say that the child is possessed by some kind of demon of sorts. Now, in talking with an archaeologist, it ended up being that their land that they have their house on was actually part of a Native American burial ground out in the back. And a few years earlier, when a fire pit was dug, they used stones that had been part of this site for their fire pit, and that this could be some of the reason why this activity was going on in the house. Eventually, the activity subsided with blessings of the house from the minister, but it was really scary for this family and for this young child to be going through all these really bad.
And that version of it necessarily leaves out a few details.
Yeah.
It would be a great movie, actually. I was somewhat frightened reading this. You know, we're running out of time here, but Walter Woodward, one thing worth saying, we were kind of alluding to it before we went on the air. At certain times in history, I mean, some of this sounds obviously like the kind of thing that hyper-rational public radio listeners would implicitly and categorically reject. But, you know, at various times, we were talking about the Hillstead. You know, when Theodate Pope was at the Hillstead, and people like William James were passing through the Hillstead, this was considered kind
Absolutely.
Of fair game.
Spiritualism was just rife in Hartford in the 19th century. Harriet Beecher Stowe practiced it. Theodate Pope Riddle was really interested in spiritualism, conducted seances. She actually boarded the Lusitania to go to Europe, to go to a psychical research conference in Britain. And she survived the sinking of the Lusitania, but three of her companions didn't. I mean, she took it very, very seriously, lost two children in the house, and tried several times to communicate with them through seances.
All right, yes. And everybody who has ever worked at the Hillstead for any length of time claims that they have seen Theodate Pope. Hey, we have to stop here. This is really – we could do four other shows here. But I just want to mention once again, David Leff is the author of Hidden in Plain Sight, A Deep Traveler Explores Connecticut. Also a new book of poetry, Tinker's Dam. He'll be doing readings all over the state. Zach Lamott is the author of Connecticut Lore, Strange, Off-Kilter, and Full of Surprises. Walter Woodward, Associate Professor of History at the University of Connecticut, the Connecticut State Historian. Thanks to John Nowinski also. Come on down to downtown Hartford, Trumbull Street tomorrow at 1. Sit in on the nose. Be our live audience. Who's getting scared? Who's getting scared now? Who's getting scared? Who's getting scared now?
I'm Kyone Wolf.
Hey, Kyone, how's it going?
The ghost? Of my cat, Momo? Hi, Momo. How are you? I miss you.
Yeah, I just want to let you know I pooped on the couch again. Sorry, because I know you cleaned it pretty good after I died.
Real poop or ghost cat poop?
Ghost cat poop.
That's the worst.